friends. Welcome back to the Thoughtful Counselor Podcast. In today's episode, Priscilla Wilson speaks with Dr. Gary Kennedy on the intersectionality of ageism and sexism. Priscilla is planning on doing a series of interviews with Dr. Gary Kennedy, so stay tuned for more on this topic. Before we get to the interview, a few housekeeping things. The Thoughtful Counselor is created in partnership with Palo Alto University's Division of Continuing and Professional Studies. Learn more at paloaltou.edu/concept. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to find podcasts, and consider leaving us a rating and review on iTunes. And lastly, go check out some of the cool things other counselors are doing with podcasts. The Theory of Change, The Reframe, and the Pod Talk Network are all podcasts created by counselors who are hosting thoughtful and interesting conversations like what we try to do on The Thoughtful Counselor. All right, I believe that's it for today. So without further ado, here's Priscilla Wilson's conversation with Dr. Gary Kennedy.
Today on The Thoughtful Counselor, I will be interviewing Dr. Gary J. Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy has quite a vita, and I'm going to go through the titles that he holds, including Professor, Department of Psychiatry, and Behavior Sciences, Vice Chair of Education, Department of Psychiatry and Behavior Sciences, Director, Division of Geriatric Psychiatry, Montefiore Medical Center at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University. Okay, well, Dr. Kennedy, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule for this interview. It is a privilege to have you on The Thoughtful Counselor. I would like to start by asking you to briefly provide some information about yourself, where you're from, your educational background, and a bit about your job.
So I'm originally from Dallas, went to University of Texas in Austin and medical school in San Antonio. But before I ever went to university, I worked as a hospital orderly, which now we would call a certified nursing assistant. Mm-hmm. So I had a very different perspective about patient care. I took orders from nurses. I dressed dead bodies for families to view them. I cleaned patients up, catheterized patients even. So I had a, what I would argue, is a little bit different perspectives from the vast majority of medical students and the students that I teach. After med school, I was interested in psychosomatic medicine and took a two-year fellowship in psychosomatic medicine at Montefiore. And that introduced me to patients with arrhythmia disturbances and with older adults. And one of the first older adults I encountered on the arrhythmia service was there for a life-threatening cardiac rhythm disturbance. But he had been a Holocaust survivor in Auschwitz.
Oh.
Was concerned that all the tests he were going through were like the tests that the Nazi doctors, like Dr. Mengele, mm-hmm. or exposing, the Jews and the camp internees to. And he knew that was not the case, but it was that his emotional reaction to it. And during the consultation liaison psychosomatic medicine fellowship, I became obsessed with the arrhythmia service and started working on a grant. And then two more years of geriatric psychiatry fellowship to foster the grant, but also because I found I enjoyed working with older adults. And because most of my work was on the inpatient side of things, that meant that I saw a lot of older adults in the medical unit, some of whom, a significant number of whom, had dementia. And I found that rather than finding those patients inaccessible and not conversant, I found that I enjoyed trying to work with them and their families. So it was a long way to get here to the present day, but something that's been very rewarding and a privilege.
Okay, well, that answers my next question about what guided you towards the field of geriatrics. So it was the work that you had done previously and with those patients that were diagnosed with dementia.
Right, and I think part of what's interesting is psychosomatic medicine and consultation psychiatry deals with people who have medical illnesses. So most of the older adults I see, have medical problems as well. So it was that mix of body and mind and emotion and sociality that I think drew me to it. So many different ways to approach the problem.
Okay. So as far as, do you have a specialty in geriatrics or just a generalist in that area?
some foci of my work, of course, is with dementia patients and, of course, dementia patients with disturbed behavior. But also, I've been working for a number of years with the Holocaust survivors and community-based agencies that serve their needs. And then also, some of my work has been with suicide in late life and younger people. So those have been areas that more specifically have been the focus. And of course, I'm a training director, so a good part of my time is really spent teaching and training.
Are you currently doing any research in the area, in the field?
The area that we're involved in currently, which is supported through the Fan Fox and Leslie Samuels Foundation, as well as the United Jewish Appeal, is working with Holocaust survivors, but also looking at the trauma-informed care. And it turns out not just Holocaust survivors, but so many people, younger and older, have survived traumatic episodes in their lives. Mm-hmm. And the rule of thumb is that resilience is the norm. Nonetheless, the trauma can sometimes make it difficult for people to trust others, have relationships of support. So we're trying to educate both our trainees in geriatric medicine, geriatric psychiatry, neurology, but also our medical students in how to work with people who have been exposed to trauma, how to approach them in a person-centered rather than simply a patient-centered way.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, well, it appears, I'll say that, even in my classes, on counseling older adults, that resilience tends to be a reoccurring theme.
I agree. And we too often think of age as decline. That's part of the reason I was interested when you asked me about ageism, as we think inevitably that it's a period of decline. And yes, you know, we slow down without question and we get sick and we die. There's no denying that. But for most older adults, there's a sense of generativity, a sense of reward and a perspective on life that's sometimes called wisdom. And of course, that can be remarkably inspiring when you're trying to take care of them and work with their families.
Okay. And the topic we're going to talk about today is the intersectionality of sexism and ageism. Can you define for our audience the terms, define ageism and types of ageism?
So the word itself comes from Robert Butler, who was the first director of the National Institute of Aging. And he had a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, basically, Why Grow Old in America? And he was arguing that so many of our social policies and our medical procedures and systems are set up that have an implicit bias against older adults. Again, the notion that older adults are a burden rather than a benefit, that they're net detractors rather than consumers and contributors to our society, our economy, our healthcare system, our educational system. So that notion that we are naturally and by upbringing, we're predisposed to think less of the older person. A good example of that, I think I mentioned once to you earlier, is that if a puppy walks into your conference room, someone wants to bend down and pick the puppy up. If an older adult comes into a conference room, you know, you're going to be nice, but you're not going to go over and hug them, welcome them the way you would a puppy. And that's called neoteny, which is a preference for the young. And of course, that has adaptive significance, because if we don't care for the young, then there won't be a generation to take care of us. But still, there are just too many examples where we are ignoring the possibility and the needs of older community. And I would also argue that it's the typical you hear that we can't afford this, we can't afford that for older persons, or there are too many people with dementia. And the reality is that I just don't buy the argument that our economy won't support providing the care and the resources that older adults and their families need. If we want their families to be even more productive, then we need to make allowances for them to take care of their older person, their older relatives.
I know that term reminds me of a counseling term. The acronym is YABIS, and it's an acronym, and the first letter in the acronym, and the acronym describes those characteristics that attract counselors to a client that we know we, I guess, subconsciously are attracted to in clients. And the Y, the first letter stands for younger or youth.
Right.
And I think Quoid, Q-U-O-I-D, is the opposite of things that we don't look for in a client. And it's quiet, ugly or unattractive, and then the O is for old and everything. So that's that reminded me of that those two.
Oh, and I would agree. That's very educational. And I think we're all subject to biases and implicit biases. We're really not aware of our preferences necessarily. That doesn't mean we can't overcome that and get to know the person and relate to them. So even if your initial response is not as positive as it should be, you know, you get to know the person and then you can warm up and be of value to them.
Are there certain public spaces in our society where ageism is more prevalent, like maybe the workplace or social settings or that you have witnessed or experienced?
Well, I can give you one patient experience that was shared with me. He was a chief of engineering at a prominent hospital here in New York City. And at age 60, there were changes in the hospital administration. And he knew that there was no chance at age 60 of him getting a comparable position in another hospital. And of course, here was a man with immense experience, tremendous energy, fine intellect, and yet he knew that that was not going to be possible. So that's, the workspace is a problem. We have the American Disability Act, which is, I'm sorry for mangling that, but it argues that we should accommodate the needs of people that can actually get the job done if we just reduce the barriers to them doing it. Mm-hmm. And I would argue the same for older adults. Also, in if you think about our streets and traffic patterns, they're not necessarily adapted for the speed with which older adults travel, by which I mean on foot. So the crosswalks need to be much more prominent. The lighting needs to be a little bit brighter. High contrast is to older adults' advantage. Also in housing, you know very well that we have a crisis in housing in the United States, mm-hmm. and it's segregated economically, racially, by language, but it's also by age as well. And I would argue that gated communities that are older adults only, no children, no pets, to me, that's not as human an atmosphere as we would want. So those are just a couple of examples. And of course, within the practice of medicine, the least appealing fellowship in psychiatry is geriatrics. And again, I think that reflects, you know, the bias that, that we would rather take care of kids because they're the future. But older adults are our past in a way that we can't appreciate from a textbook. There's nothing like hearing an older adult recite their struggles and their triumphs and the difficulties they experienced culturally and otherwise as a younger person.
Mm-hmm. What about population-wise? I know I've discussed with my students the increase in the population of adults ages 65 and older, especially over the upcoming decades, 2030, 2040, 2050.
Well, of course, there are going to be more and more older adults, no question about that. Also, the related to that is the fear that the number of people with dementia is going to be increasing. And actually, that's true. The prevalence and the absolute number of people with dementia will increase, but there are going to be more older adults that are relatively independent than there are people with dementia. Mm-hmm. So again, we don't want to misidentify aging as an illness and call and say, well, you'll hear people say, well, if you get old enough, you're depressed or demented. And that's just not true at all. Now, the sad fact, and one of the fastest growing components of our population are people 85 years of age and older. But the sad fact, due to the crisis with the opioids, increased alcohol, increased suicide rates, that lifespan is actually declining. So we're going to be losing a number of older, and part of the generation that would make this increase in the absolute number of older adults. So there's no guarantee that we're going to have you know, a healthy, active lifespan. It has to be worked on. We have to have policies that support it.
Yes. And I know that I've asked you about speaking in the future on different topics related to aging. So those are going to be some really interesting topics that we will look at as well. But going back to intersectionality of ageism and gender, regarding genders, how is ageism different? How do you, what does the research show and your experience?
Well, the research, sad to say, is relatively clear that older women and older minorities get less care and less aggressive procedures than one would expect. And sad to say, they may also get less palliative care and hospice care approaches. And again, this is the issue of not only advanced age, but sexism comes into the play. And recall also that the simple majority of older adults are older women, but because they've not been in positions of power, because it's only now that we're starting to see half the class of medical students as women, you know, there still is this power differential and lack of awareness. So again, there's a kind of built-in bias that is not necessarily malicious. I mean, it's not necessarily purposeful, but it's implicit, and it's going to change as more and more women enter the healthcare and policymaking workforce.
Mm-hmm. And there are many examples of sexism in regards to women in the media. Looking at films and television and the pairings of older men with, it tends to be younger women and everything. And as women get to a certain age, they just become less and less visible in the media. So that's something that, you know, I don't know how I would say is acceptable in our society, but that's what the media, you know, portrays to us.
Well, you only have to look at older actresses. When they start to look like grandmothers, there's no romantic interest that they can play in a film. And yet older adults, even up to age 90, you know, they have desires for one another. If they have a partner, then older adults, and if they were active when they were younger, then they're likely to have an active sexual life. Not as frequently, but doesn't mean it's not as meaningful.
Mm-hmm. I know that, and was reading an article yesterday on, Gina Davis. And it's been a while since I've seen her in the media and everything, but then last week, there's Tom Cruise, and they're coming out with another Top Gun, and he's paired with a younger woman and everything. So, I mean, that's just very interesting how Hollywood, just pairs partners and everything, and how women of a certain age, seems to be 40s or 50s, tend to be less and less visible on the screen. Especially as love interest or in those sort of roles and everything.
Oh, I agree. There are two examples counter to that. One is the actress Judi Dench playing the role of M, the boss of James Bond. And she's an incredible actor, but it really worked well. Mm-hmm. So you break the stereotype and it becomes even more dramatic. And the other example to cite is Emmanuel Macron, the president of France.
Oh, yes.
His wife is visibly older than him. Mm-hmm. So it's, there are examples we have to point out. We can't just say it's all bad, but we do have to use the positive examples as proof that there are bad examples, too.
This is true. My next question was about in healthcare settings, and you addressed that. What about discrepancies in mental health in regards to age and sexism?
So I'll give you one example. Both in New York and in the state of New York and the state of Massachusetts, if your diagnosis is dementia, then you are barred from coming to what's called a certified mental health clinic. And if your diagnosis is depression secondary to dementia, okay. But there are so many other behavioral disturbances. So that's an age-related bias that I hope is going to be eliminated at some point. So that's one example of how age, and dementia, of course, is not caused by age, but it is age-related. So that's a policy that I think is just wrong. And of course, much of my work with patients who have dementia, also called a neurocognitive disorder, is with their families. So it's not unusual that the way I code my visit is family therapy. And of course, again, the best medicine for a person with dementia is the family, but they just need support and they need direction. Some family members get it. They never need to see a psychiatrist. Other family members, it's just really hard. And they're trying, but it's not natural to them in some sort of sense. So you need to be available to them.
In regards to dementia, what is the prevalence gender-wise? Are there more women diagnosed or men, or not any significant difference?
The prevalence among women is slightly higher, but in part that's because they have a survival advantage. So they're lasting longer into the period of risk. Okay. So, but there's nothing that I know of about gender per se that predisposes someone to dementia. Now, men have greater cardiovascular disease, and it's clear that cardiovascular disease, whether it's contributing to Alzheimer's disease or to contributing to brain disease through stroke, that's going to be somewhat more common in men. It's becoming more common in women as they live longer, too. But that probably accounts for the difference in the prevalence rates and incidence rates.
Mm-hmm. And also with family support, I think about caregivers. Are there more women who are taking that role of caregivers, and what is the toll mentally on them?
Well, no question about it. If you actually look at the statistics and bar graphs, you find that older men, no matter what their race or ethnicity is, are likely to be cared for by someone in the family, and typically that's a woman in the family. If it's an older woman, some of them are living alone and really don't have the kind of care support. So it's unusual for an older man to be alone. It's not unusual for an older woman to be alone. And of course, you may have heard the term sandwich generation.
Yes, I have.
These are mothers who are also daughters, and they're taking care of their mother or their husband's mother or their parents, either one, you know, mothers or fathers. But then they have the kids to take care of. Mm-hmm. And yes, we have more women in the workforce and more men who are assuming childcare responsibilities, but still the overwhelming burden of brokering healthcare falls to the women in the family.
So I want and I know there is an impact mentally on women in that role and everything. Could you talk about that as far as women who are caregivers, especially those who are in the sandwich generation?
Well, of course, to start on a positive note, caregiving can be very rewarding.
Yes, it can.
And can be, inspiring, a sense of being able to give back some of what you received from a loving parent. But those are not people who come to see me for mental health care. More often, it's people who may have had an abusive parent, or there's conflict or difficulty within the family. That's not unusual. And when caregiver is stretched between spouse or partner, caring for an older parent or relative, and then for children, it can be overwhelming, just the amount of time that's having to be devoted. And it turns out that most of the problems with elder abuse are not because of malicious caregivers, but caregivers are just overloaded, overburdened by it. It's a big problem.
And so going back to ageism and sexism, what is the impact of ageism on older women?
Well, I think it has to do with limitation in services, Social Security, Medicare. When Social Security was originally developed under Roosevelt and promulgated by Francis Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, part of the argument for Social Security was it should be available for widows of coal miners. So that was a kind of introduction, but as you know, Social Security has not kept up. We have a cap on the income to which Social Security tax applies, and I think it's $132,000 per year. And of course, if older women are the major recipients of Social Security, then making that cap ensures that they're at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why you hear worries periodically that we can't afford Social Security. Well, yes, we can't afford it if we don't decide to pay for it. And that currently is, the limit on the policy, which I think is unfortunate. And again, if more men were the recipients of Social Security, we might see a different perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. And mental health issues. What mental health issues do you see as a result of ageism, especially towards women?
Well, again, the mental health is stigmatized. Mental health care is stigmatized. So both the patients and the providers are stigmatized by biases about mental illness, that it can't be treated, or that people, the mentally ill, are just weak-willed. They're basically bad people. They deserve all the misfortune they're encountering. So we still have this kind of bias as well against mental health. The example I like to use is the next time you're at a party, introduce yourself as a psychiatrist. And watch the person's reaction. I always love to do that. But we don't make services as available as they should be. We're not training anywhere near the number of specialists in geriatrics and geriatric psychiatry or geriatric psychiatric nurse practitioners or even counselors, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to respond to your request, is we have to broaden the workforce if we're going to help older adults.
Yes, there needs to be more emphasis on working with clients over the age of 65.
I agree.
I did a workshop last year for our State Counseling Association, geriatric counseling. It was moderately attended. There's still that perception in society about getting older that we need to resist, that we need to deconstruct and reconstruct with a positive perception and everything. As far as mental health counselors, I know we need to gain that competency, but what could you recommend for counselors to assist clients who are 65 and older, especially those who may have encountered sexism? Ableism and sexism.
Well, think of it, think of sexism as not just an attitude, but a cause or progenitor of trauma. So asking the person, and again, this is sensitive, it has to be approached in a, I want to ask you something. If it's too sensitive, I'll respect your wish not to pursue it. I'm not trying to force you to talk about it, but I'm here to listen if you want to. And were you ever abused by someone? That would be one evidence of sexism. Or did in the workplace, whether it's military or civilian, did you ever encounter attitudes that you felt were unfair or you were treated unfairly? So to make it clear to the person that in a non-judgmental but an empathic fashion, you want to listen if they want to talk. If it's too sensitive for them to broach the subject, then you're going to respect that. And you may keep the conversation more concrete about what services you can help the person with or about what kind of negotiations you can help them with, either with their family or their physicians or other people that are involved in their care. Mm-hmm. So I think what you want to do is to become an ally.
Okay.
And avoid being an adversary.
Okay. What about the client that may be reluctant to counseling? A lot of older adults, those rugged individualists, I can do it on my own and everything. What about those that may be reluctant about counseling or being mysterious?
You mean older males?
Either gender.
I'm teasing. Again, when I encounter someone who is, and of course I have worked with older adults who had psychotherapy when they were younger people, or when even their middle age, and you know, when we start the conversation, they just take off, they're veterans of therapy. But someone who's never encountered that, you know, it's a little threatening. So part of what the approach I'll use is, if I think I'm pushing the person away with my questions, if they feel like I'm intruding, I'll try and change the subject to something that's a safer topic, like, of course, where were you born? What kind of work did you do? Were you in the service? How did you meet your spouse? What was it like last holiday? Mm-hmm. So to get off a more sensitive topic like loss of independence, or threat because of poor health, or because of a spouse's poor health, a partner's poor health, then to try and make it a more social encounter. Now, that I know that sounds manipulative, but the point I'm trying to make is you want to form an alliance with a person, and you don't want to be seen as a threat. Mm-hmm. So a man I saw at the nursing home actually last week, advanced dementia and terrible delirium, he was just so upset. It was just heartbreaking. And he was screaming at us. And I told him, you know, I'm a doctor. What kind of work did you do? And he told me he was a salesman. And that was, you know, that was non-threatening, and he didn't feel like I was might harm him. And I asked him, I'm from Texas. Where are you from? And of course, he told me New York. And that's a sensitive question nowadays, because if you ask a person, where are you from, they may think that you're prejudiced against them because they might be an immigrant or some different area. That's the reason I preface with, I'm from Texas, where are you from? Mm-hmm. It makes it sound like I'm really curious. I'm not accusatory.
Mm-hmm. Are there any specific areas in geriatrics that counselors and me teaching students that we really need to hone in on?
Well, the most sensitive area, and something that will push the older person back away from your relationship, is to start too early about finances. Because money is the most sensitive question you can ask a person about, because it symbolizes so much, their independence, their safety. A topic that we avoid too often is asking the person about intimate relations, sexuality. Yeah. Now, of course, if the person has not had a partner for 15, 20 years, they may no longer have any interest. Because for some people, if they're not engaged in intimate activity, then their interest in activity just dissipates. Mm-hmm. But that shouldn't mean we don't ask them about it.
Okay. My last question, going back to the topic of ageism and sexism. Do you see discrepancies improving, say, over the past 10, 20, 30 years? Are there any improvements that you have witnessed?
Oh, without question, I think in both. Part of what's distressing is that we become aware of these problems, become aware of these biases. But if you think about it, that's really a good sign, is that we're starting to acknowledge. Now, that doesn't mean you drop your biases, but if you're aware of them, then you can cope with that. So I think things are much better. As I mentioned, a simple example, the number of women that are entering medical school at Einstein College of Medicine, where I teach, you know, half the class are women. In our psychiatry program, more than half the class who are psychiatric residents are women. And that's a trend that's going to increase.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add to the 40 listeners?
Oh, just the satisfaction it is talking with older adults, and when you form a relationship, and how much they can be open and appreciative of a younger person's interest. sometimes younger doctors and medical students think the older person is just not going to trust them because they're so young. Exactly the opposite. When you're a young counselor, young person inquiring about the older adult in a sincere fashion, mm-hmm. they're very open, non-threatened by a younger person. So youth has its advantages.
Okay. Dr. Kennedy, thank you. Thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule for this interview. And I will be getting in touch with you later on to talk about other topics regarding older adults. I just feel like this is a very, very important area that counselors need to gain competency in. With the increased population of adults 65 and older, I just feel like mental health is just as important as physical health and everything. And we just need more counselors who are competent, who can show empathy, mutual empathy, and understanding, inform, like you said, allegiances with our clients.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Dr. Wilson. It was a pleasure.
The Thoughtful Counselor is Aaron Smith, Allison Kramer, Megan Speciale, Priscilla Wilson, Raisa Miller, Stephen Dixon, and me, Mike Shook. You can find us online at thethoughtfulcounselor.com. Our funding is provided by Palo Alto University's Division of Continuing and Professional Studies. You can learn more at paloaltou.edu/concept. The views and opinions expressed on The Thoughtful Counselor are those of the individual authors and contributors and do not necessarily represent those of other authors and contributors, nor of Palo Alto University. Lastly, if you have an idea for an episode, general feedback about the podcast, or just want to reach out to us, you can email us at thethoughtfulcounselor@gmail.com. See you next week.